Welcome to the Best Science Medicine Podcast, BS without the BS.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the 401st episode of the Best Science Medicine Podcast. My name is James McCormack, and I'm a professor with the Faculty of Pharmaceutical Sciences at the University of British Columbia.
I'm Mike Allen. I'm a family doctor and a professor at the University of Alberta, as well as the director of program and practice support with the College of Family Physicians of Canada.
So since the 400th episode, we're trying to prove to the world that we're not therapeutic nihilists.
No.
And if you were paying attention to the previous podcast, we gave a bunch of numbers about how about the effectiveness of, you know, treating real high blood pressure, treating heart failure, and those sorts of things. And you know, with real high blood pressure, we're talking about absolute reductions in the, you know, maybe even 5 to 10%. You know,
yeah, and we were talking about numbers north of 180 systolic.
Yeah. And
to start, not get to.
No, and that's over 5 years. Or in some of them, it's actually shorter, but probably 2 to 3 years is what we're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And then when we, you know, with lower numbers, we're really in the neighborhood of, you know, maybe 1 or 2%, maybe if you can push it up to 3%. And then we did some stuff on heart failure, where we talked about the absolute benefits of using the allosterin antagonists or the beta blockers with absolute reductions and also ACE inhibitors of somewhere between 5 to 10%.
Right.
And again, that's over 2 years usually.
Right.
And then we did the atrial fibrillation, where the absolute reduction in stroke was, it depended on the CHAD score, but you know, you could anywhere from a sort of a 2% absolute benefit over a year upwards of 12% absolute benefit over a year or so. And so we want to continue on that theme. And I think, Mike, you're going to lead us down a couple of pathways. We're going to talk about in context where maybe diabetes fits in.
Right.
And then we'll also go back to lifestyle as well.
Right. And we're going to jump into diabetes now, because I think diabetes is one of these areas that, sure, there are symptomatic elements to the condition, even in its early stages, if sugars go very high.
Yeah.
But for the most part, it's an asymptomatic condition that you're working at preventing long-term consequences. And what happens in diabetes when it's studied is aspirin is looked at, and glycemic control, or a certain elements of glycemic control specifically in large trials. But really what we'd like to know as well is, can we, if we kind of manage in a global sense, risk factors and risk elements of diabetes, can we reduce cardiovascular disease? And I think of all the trials, the one that sticks out in everyone's mind when you talk about that is the Steno trial.
Mm-hmm.
And Steno was a 6 or 7 year trial that was then extended. And so we're going to give you the extension data, which is 13 years. This is taking high risk diabetics, or diabetics for a number of years, who also have microalbuminuria, not because that matters to patients. I'm not bringing that up, but it's a signal of risk. It's a signal that the disease is potentially progressing. So what did they find in that? Well, over the 13 years, mortality was 50% in the placebo group versus 70% in the Steno aggressive arm. So what is the Steno aggressive arm? Well, that's basically, they set a bunch of targets, both systolic and diastolic blood pressure, glycemic targets, and some cholesterol targets. Those were they were five anyway. There were two for cholesterol, one for glycemic control, and two for hypertension. The important thing to remember is at year 13, this is a small trial, 80 people in each arm. At year 13, only one patient in the aggressive arm was actually at all the targets. So 79 out of the 80 were not hitting targets. Yeah. And that's why we say, this is just one of the many potential arguments for stop worrying about targets, worrying about the right interventions. Because what also happened in Steno is they were advocating strongly for lifestyle. They were pushing, and they had visits at home for these patients to help with lifestyle and diet and exercise. For example, the aggressive arm was on average had twice as much exercise in any given week as the non-aggressive arm. So it's not simply looking at metformin or empagliflozin or anything like that. In fact, this was before empagliflozin, mm-hmm. but this is looking at, what if we try and do as much as we can for these patients? There is a risk to that, as you know, James, that we can overburden them with medical care where life is gradually erodes. the quality of life. But it is important to recognize that this is the only trial really that I can think of where they found a reduction in an actual statistical difference. And I think it was 5% or something close to that in dialysis.
Yeah, yeah. And it is the only study, and there's been a trial. This was, in a very small population in people who are at, sort of what we higher risk because they've got all of the risk factors associated with it. So there was that sort of benefit. But, it's actually this type of approach has been studied in a much broader population, I think in the neighborhood 3 or 4,000 people, not shown any benefit.
Well, you have to be careful.
Almost no benefit. Right. Nothing even close to this.
Right. Nothing close to this. And a couple of caveats with that. Yeah. In that trial, it was, again, aggressive management versus non-aggressive management. But the trouble was, if you looked at ACE inhibitor prescribing, ACE inhibitors in the non-aggressive arm were 75%, yeah, and in the aggressive arm were 80%.
Yeah, so you could only be so aggressive because you've already gotten some of the treatments. And yeah.
The usual care arm was aggressive treatment by previous standards. Mm-hmm. So you're not going to see those. Everything was headed in the right direction. Nothing was statistically significant.
Yeah.
But you can fathom from that trial that there is potential benefit. It's just that the baseline arm, it's kind of like the study of PSA, where many studies of PSA, the differences between the intervention arm and the control arm are virtually nil. Where, for example, in the study done in Quebec, one of the original studies of the PSA, that the number of people getting at least one PSA was in the 20% range in the PSA arm versus the non-PSA arm, which was around 13%.
Yeah.
So virtually
you're not
going to see anything.
But so there appears to be something if you sort of overall manage type 2 diabetics.
Right.
And the issue is, and we're not pushing one drug over another, because what we have seen in the most recent trials, we've talked about diabetes at length, and we'll just give you some sort of ballpark numbers. And the ballpark numbers I kind of talk about are, with the SGLT2s or the GLPs or whatever, most actual medications for type 2 diabetes don't have a lot of evidence of any benefit from a glucose lowering. But the newer ones, some of the newer ones, not all of them that come out, you're seeing, maybe benefits in the 2-3%.
Right. And it's important to remember, you're getting that benefit in part because these are higher risk patients.
Yeah. Yeah.
The relative benefits here for those medicines that work, you've listed them already.
Yeah.
The SGLT2s and the GLP-1s, they have a 15% relative reduction in cardiovascular disease. And so the effects, because that reduction is small. Now, how did they react to that, James? How did the community?
Oh, yeah. I mean, everyone was thrilled that, they were thrilled that they weren't killing everyone.
Right.
Because we have, bad outcomes. And as you're pointing out, Mike, almost all the other stuff that we were talking about, obviously not the heart failure, is that was primary prevention. Many of the new drugs are being tested in people who have already had cardiovascular events. Not all of them. But that's where we're seeing the 2-5%. You might see quite a bit less in the people
who primary prevention.
Yeah. So, and we don't really know exactly what the benefit is. And there was, fortunately, a benefit in mortality is one as well. Maybe a 1%. Maybe you could argue maybe 1.5%. So there is. It's not completely hopeless, and you don't need to be a complete therapeutic nihilist. But you certainly need to be somewhat of a nihilist when it comes to this, because we don't have great evidence for things like the insulins and the glyburides.
If anything, we have evidence that they're not very effective at reducing hard outcomes, at least not the macrovascular ones, which are the most common outcomes.
Yeah, exactly.
But there's the other key drugs, metformin, and you and I can debate for a long time, does it actually work?
Yeah. I mean, it works for lower glucose, but there literally is just the one study.
And then there's another poorer study that suggests a benefit after some adjustments.
Yeah, some major adjustments. And there's other ones
that showed no effect.
Well-designed, showing no difference in other agents and so on. So it gets very confusing. And again, we just want you to not hurt people with these drugs.
But an ASA, we could say that probably... But let's get back to being the happy, positive, sunshine people that we are for this podcast.
Yeah, so go ahead. You want me to say something then?
No, that's you. In that case, it's me.
Oh, okay, good.
Yeah. So, but blood pressure and statin therapy, we know, are beneficial. Mm-hmm. Lifestyle, things like that. We'll get to lifestyle in a second. But for example, we had Dr. Hayward from Veterans Affairs Group come out and talk at our conference a number of years ago. And he had a great little speech, and he was basically, if you're trying to prevent significant adverse events in diabetics, it's blood pressure, statins, blood pressure, sugar. And he was just, and the data does support that. There's no direct comparisons where we're going to take hypertensive diabetics and treat one arm with sugar medicines and treat the other arm.
We don't,
And nor should we ever do that.
And the other thing that you should add is, and get them off aspirin.
Get them off aspirin.
Yeah, so that they don't harm themselves.
Yeah, so the aspirin trials, so the original trials with diabetics didn't find a thing. There is a new trial that just came out, which I think we've covered, which shows a small benefit with aspirin, but an equal amount of harm.
Yeah, so it's really,
I don't think, I'm beginning to think that in primary prevention, there is no role for aspirin at all.
Yeah,
no, and the whole talk about prevention of colon cancers and that, though the three largest trials found not even a signal of benefit in cancer. So, in fact, one found harm.
So, So we've primarily touched on drug therapy, but we would be remiss. That's always such a that word makes you sound so smart. You'd be remiss if you were not to talk about other the things that we can do for ourselves, so to speak.
Right. So there's we talked a lot about. A lot about diabetes, and the last ones were more clear-cut. Diabetes, it's a little bit harder, but do remember, blood pressure treatment really does work in them with a 30 to 50% relative risk benefit, and statin therapy with a 25 to 35%. So those are for the medications, but let's get to lifestyle now. Now, this was a fascinating study that took patients with stable angina, and they were going to send them for angioplasty. So they were offered angioplasty versus a bicycle, a stationary bike.
And you had to, you couldn't just get the bike. You actually had to do something.
You had to do something. You had to ride it virtually every day. And I forget whether it was, I think it was 20 minutes every day to just shy of where you would get chest pain symptoms or angina symptoms, like significant shortness of breath. Or, and then on day seven of that week, you had to ride for 40 minutes. So that was 20 minutes every day and then 40 minutes. And this was one of those studies that James had mentioned earlier in the last podcast that kind of pooled all vascular events together. But still, the difference was in the angioplasty arm, 30% of patients had some kind of vascular outcome, like recurrence of angina or MI, versus 12% in the bicycle arm.
Yeah.
That's an 18% absolute difference in only 12 months and a number needed to treat of six.
Yeah. Now, that's, you know, a single trial.
And it is a single and a small trial.
And you need it, you know, it'd be great to have it sort of repeated. And when you look at all of the evidence that we have for exercise, and I like to actually just call it activity because exercise is, I mean,
it's a dirty word.
It's a dirty word. It's like diet.
And it's a four-letter word.
Yeah. And when you look at all of the best available, and these are difficult studies to do at best, is they're only marginally easier than nutrition trials, is that, you know, you see a relative benefit of 25 to 30% with activity. And now I was going to say it doesn't cost anything. That's not true. There's cost associated with it. If you buy this stuff that you know, you buy the bicycle or whatever.
Right.
But the good thing about it is that you not only get the cardiovascular benefit, you also get improvements in quality of life in general. Obviously, if you're out biking and you get hit by a car, that's
a bad outcome.
That immediately you've now lost any hope of getting overall
benefit. And the bike is
toast. Yeah.
So having been someone who's been hit more than once, so and partly my own fault from I'm a cyclist, or used to be. Mm-hmm. But this is still, you know, these are big, relatively big benefits, big reductions in cardiovascular disease. And I recognize it's a small trial. Other ones didn't find as big a benefit. This one found bigger benefits for a couple of reasons. Mm-hmm. They took high risk patients, they did something quite attainable, and they did it in a country. This was done in Scandinavia, and the compliance rates in Scandinavia often are a little bit better. And so it was really people more engaged in the intervention. There was another study done. This was a fascinating little study, and they had eight different quality of life measures to kind of look at contentness and happiness. And they these were women in their kind of 50 to 60 year old, generally around their 50s, and randomized to four different levels of activity, kind of baseline, very little, half of what was being recommended in the US at the time, a full amount, and then 1.5 times the amount. And what they found was absolutely fascinating, and I encourage you guys to look this up. It was published in the Archives of Internal Medicine in 2009. And what they found was that the people who were randomized to this, in 7 out of 8 quality of life measures, there was a clear linear relationship between how much exercise you were doing and your quality of life. So if you were at baseline, if you went to half of what was recommended, your quality of life went up. If you went to a full, it went up again. And if you went to the 1.5, it went up yet again.
Yeah.
And it's very few interventions we have, James, that on 7 out of 8 measures,
the quality of life goes up.
All of that consistently goes up.
Yeah, like, and so, but again, we want to make sure that this has to be activity that you enjoy.
Right. But and, no, but I also want to state that, you know, the dose response curves are not
exactly.
This is a linear
which relationship. You just don't see with other things.
There's no other intervention.
And when it comes to, you know, the benefit of activity, very few people go, I just feel good taking a statin. It feels, you know, I my quality of life has improved. It never improves your quality of life.
No, virtually nothing.
I'm sick. I need something. I got a cholesterol issue. Blah blah blah. Whereas when you have this, and so that's why, even if the relative benefits are similar, we have so many additional advantages to it, like the quality of life, and you know, it's why we promote it. You know, the evidence is not as clear, but it's more difficult to do this research. So, in our minds, I think it's a no-brainer to attempt to get people to be more physically active, but it's got to be something they enjoy and that they'll stick to. There's no point in being physically active for a month,
right?
And that sort of stuff. And then the last one, maybe smoking. I mean, is that where you wanted to go with this?
Yeah.
Or are you done?
I've done preaching enough about exercise and activity. I think that our listeners know this, but it's important to remember that there are clinical trials out there. The evidence is not as strong as statins per se, where you're randomizing 30,000 people, but it is relatively robust evidence showing clear and benefit more than just what we talked about with the medicines, which is, you know, quality of life and more than just mortality, but quality of life, sleeping, avoidance of depression, all of these things have been documented.
Yeah. And those are the things that you don't get the benefit from drugs.
Yeah. In almost all cases.
Yeah.
But let's talk about smoking, because I think the first time I ever heard this was from you, James, because you had read this Cochrane review, that just asking about smoking cessation in a given year increases chance, like a physician asking, increases the chances of a patient quitting by 2 to 3%.
Yeah.
Which seems tiny, but for an intervention
where you're literally saying, are you interested in stopping?
Are you interested? Yeah. And that's, it's not a lot more. Yeah. And that will reduce, hard clinical endpoints for them 50% of those patients.
Mm-hmm.
Like that's a dramatic effect. And I know it's only 2 to 3%, but that turnaround, the benefit is so high if they embrace it.
Yeah.
So what about, this was a lovely clinical trial. And what they did in this clinical trial is they took a number of patients who had just had an MI and they randomized them to two groups. One was an aggressive smoking cessation group, and the other one was a non-aggressive smoking cessation group. And in the aggressive smoking cessation group, what they got was 39% were quitting versus only 9% in the, interestingly, over 90% of people say after their MI that they want to quit smoking.
Yeah.
But how many actually attain that? Well, the average is only about 9%.
Yeah, which is quite amazing. I mean, it just shows you the power of nicotine.
The absolute power of nicotine. Yeah, so this is 2 years out. Out of the 90% who wanted to quit, only 9% have actually quit at 2 years versus 39%. And what they did is gave them a lot of counseling options, gave them a lot of support, and also provided, this was a US study, nicotine replacement therapy and bupropion. And at the time of this trial, varenicline was just becoming, just coming to market, so it wasn't available. Long story short, at the end, number needed to treat for death was 11. So about a 10% reduction in death in 2 years.
Yeah.
With only 39% versus 9% quitting. So even though less than half of the patients quit, we're still seeing a massive reduction, or I would consider a pretty large reduction in mortality for such a simple intervention. Number needed to treat six to avoid hospitalization.
Yeah, no. And again, there's so many limitations to some of this research, but it's the results are compelling.
Yeah.
And, you know, when you stop smoking, it's less expensive. And almost none of this deals with the issues of, none of this would look at, is there a benefit from a cancer perspective or COPD perspective or anything. So it's
a slam dunk.
Yeah.
So, but a good reminder of that there are things that we can do that are so simple that can make such a huge difference.
Yeah. And it's a matter of how do you, and I think some of it just involves a discussion. I mean, obviously you and I think maybe even more me, I'm in favor of having a discussion about the evidence as much as you can. Mm-hmm. And if you know ballpark numbers, which is what we're trying to give you, then you can have those discussions. And we're hoping that at least from this perspective, from cardiovascular and that we're not coming across as these nihilists.
Yeah.
These things work, but they are not in any way, shape or form working for everybody.
Right.
I mean, as much as you can say will work for everybody, it's smoking and activity. And we haven't really touched on nutrition, but we've done so many podcasts on that. I don't think we need to go into that. And that is at best tricky. We can't be all that clear when it comes to nutrition other than, you know, the Mediterranean diet in moderation and so on. Right. And we're not going to talk about weight loss and those sorts of things. That's another whole other topic. But so as much as we've done in these last two podcasts is give you pretty much an overview of all of the evidence that we have for these different prevention issues, heart failure, AFib, blood pressures, and so on. And then, you know, wanting you guys to focus on the whole concept of lifestyle issues. And, you know, as we're talking here, I think, you know, it may be of benefit even, you know, if you're really keen on these podcasts and this information, hopefully we've said it in the way that maybe even patients would understand.
Yeah.
I don't speak usually at a different level when I'm talking to patients than I do to healthcare providers, because it's all, you know, a discussion about those sorts of things. And so maybe you could get your patients to listen to these sorts of things.
So I think we need to mention, though, because we've given the other two main lifestyle, which is activity and smoking cessation, we should mention diet and at least give our listeners the numbers again. Mm-hmm. So it was kind of a 30, depending on what you read. Like if you read the earlier trials of the Mediterranean diet, which were in patients with cardiovascular disease, the benefits were quite a bit larger. Those were older Lancet trials. But if you read the newer one, the PrettyMed study, we're looking at about a 1-2% benefit over, what was it, James, 4 years,
yeah,
something like that. And it was around a 30% reduction. If in simplicity's sake, it was almost identical to what we see with statins. Mm-hmm.
And that's not doing a heck of a lot. It's not taking, you know, a person who's, you don't have to make drastic lifestyle changes.
No.
I mean, they, you know, a lot of these, that PrettyMed was, you know, adding in using, you know, virgin olive oil or increasing the number of nuts that you're eating and all that sort of stuff. And, you know, following a bit more of a Mediterranean style thing. But it's not, you know, if it's real and it's tricky, because it's a single trial, it's unblinded.
There are other trials. There are two other trials, but they were in people with mostly with cardiovascular disease, some variation of the Mediterranean diet. And it's important to remember, like people say, well, what is exactly the Mediterranean diet? Well, it's not exact.
No.
If you Google it and look up a couple of pyramids, food pyramids, you've pretty much nailed it.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, one of them said, eat more bread.
Yeah, no,
I mean,
exactly.
It was so. I'm not suggesting that everyone needs to eat, but so that's kind of the Mediterranean diet. People will talk about lifestyle or talk about weight loss. The biggest thing I think we're finding over and over again is what diet will you stick with? That's all that matters. Like again, we just saw this huge trial, and I think it was in JAMA, looking at, you know, whether you were eating the ketogenic or low carb diet and
quite ketogenic.
Well, the original, it started as keto and then gradually allowed you to add back in some carbs. But the thing that really matters in that, James, is that the differences between the diets is often in the 1 kilogram range, but the differences between individual adherence drives kilogram differences of 30 kilogram weight loss to 10 kilogram gain.
Yeah,
that's where the differences are. So it's about And I know this comes as a shock, and hopefully most of you are able to sit down, but adherence actually matters in what diet you're doing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. No,
so,
for sure.
So it's just, that's all that there is to weight loss. It's about, there's nothing magical. It's whether you stick to it or not. And as far as like living longer or healthier, the best available evidence consistently has shown the Mediterranean diet. Yeah. That's our best guess.
And if you unfortunately, if you're on a diet or nutrition that you don't like, you may not live longer. It'll just feel like you've lived longer because it'll be so painful.
So that's about all of our kind of prevention type mm-hmm. stuff, James. So
yeah,
maybe
yeah.
we should do one more podcast with all of the kind of symptomatic, making people feel better.
Yeah, maybe more than one. We'll see how it goes. But yeah, so we've tried to cover as much as we can of the issues of, you know, lifestyle and medications for primary and some secondary prevention stuff. And so I think we will leave it at that. So thanks as always for listening.
Talk to you later.